You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next this hour, microbiology post 9/11. A presidential report out this week warns that the next major attack on America may come in the form of biological warfare, and said that the intelligence community needs to approach the problem with a new urgency and with new strategies. Spending on biodefense research has increased dramatically since September 11th. New labs are opening up in many parts of the country, set to do work on some of the most feared potential bioterror agents of our time, such as anthrax and tularemia. So how do we manage the research? How do scientists decide what to publish, what to keep secret? And in light of this report, should a tighter lid be clamped on just what scientists can work on or report on in journals? Or should they be allowed to arrive at their own code of ethics voluntarily? Let me introduce my guest to talk about that, Ronald Atlas. He is past president of the American Society for Microbiology. He's also graduate dean, professor of biology and public health, and co-director of the Center for Deterrence of Biowarfare and Bioterrorism at the University of Louisville. He joins us today from Louisville. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Atlas.
Hi there, Ira.
Hi there.
How are
you? You know, the last time you were on, we talked about the struggle to find the right balance between publishing information and withholding it because someone might want to do harm with it. Have you reached a compromise, or what about that struggle?
We're still in the midst of that struggle, although I think increasingly we recognize that it must be the scientific community and not government that comes forward to govern what we tell others about the work we do.
Are you then fearful of this new report that came out this week saying we need to be more careful about bioterrorism warfare?
No, I think it's a debate that we've had ongoing. We've had it with government representatives. And it's clear that the life sciences are fundamentally different from nuclear science and other arms areas, that it's an international endeavor, and that the fundamental premise, one that, in fact, Condoleezza Rice has put forward and has been endorsed by the government, is that the presumption must be for openness first, and only where we have clear reason to think that there's dangerous information do we build walls around it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you just came out with a code of ethics published in this week's Science magazine. You have 9 points on it, and it's basically something that's voluntary. Can you give us some of the high points of what that code involves?
Yeah, I think that we've not had a code before for much of science, certainly not embracing the life sciences. And the code was written by Margaret Somerville at McGill University, a bioethicist and lawyer by training, and myself, a true practicing microbiologist. And what we saw was a need to extend the sort of concept of the Hippocratic Oath first, that scientists must first and foremost seek to do no harm. Beyond that, we try to seek to do good. And in that vein, we have to pay increased attention today to biosafety, biosecurity, and the ethical conduct of our research.
Mm-hmm. Your first point says that biologists need to work to ensure that their discoveries and knowledge do no harm, just like the Hippocratic Oath, first and foremost.
That's correct. And we call upon all scientists of the world to avoid engaging in activities that contribute to the threat of bioterrorism or biowarfare. We've unfortunately in the past had some scientists who have decided there are other callings and who have engaged in bioweapons research. Today, through the Biological Weapons Convention and resolutions of the United Nations, biological weapons are considered the only weapon that is totally banned.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Ronald Atlas about a code of ethics for life sciences. Of course, some people will say, you know, why just make it a code? Why not just codify it into law? How would you respond to that?
And the problem is, for much of this, we're dealing in very gray areas. On the one hand, we have biodefense research, which must go forward. And on the other hand, we have bioweapons development, which must not occur. But there are certainly areas of science where the two come together and where we're trying to measure intent. In other areas, what we're really saying is that we have legitimate information. We're finding information about how to discover a new drug or vaccine that will protect public health, but someone else might misuse it. And so we don't want to ban or otherwise codify in law the prohibition of generating that information, but we want to carefully examine it. Beyond that, though, there are things that have been codified in law. We have new laws governing who has access to the most dangerous pathogens, like the agents that cause anthrax and smallpox and tularemia. And the code of ethics that we've written says we must abide by those laws and regulations, that as scientists, we are not above the law.
So are you hoping that scientists will individually adopt this code of ethics? Where would you take it from here?
We're hoping, first of all, that this will be embraced by the scientific community around the world. This is not just an American issue. And that scientists using this code as a model will begin to discuss the steps that we all must take to help protect the public. We do have a responsibility to society to help avoid the misuse of the information that we generate.
Let me move on to another issue. In February of this year, a letter signed by over 700 scientists was presented to Dr. Zerhouni, who is the head of the National Institutes of Health. And signers of the letter complained that too much money is being spent on biodefense research that's sort of being diverted, that money coming from other important areas of research. Let me read a line from the letter. It says, "The diversion of research funds from projects of high public health importance to projects of high biodefense but low public health importance represents a misdirection of NIH priorities and a crisis for NIH-supported microbiologist research." How do you respond to that?
There is a genuine concern in the scientific community that we continue to do fundamental research that will help protect against infectious diseases like AIDS and malaria and other diseases that are occurring around the world. This particular letter expressed the concern that, in fact, money was being diverted from those efforts to the biodefense area. National Institutes of Health has responded by posting answers on a website which indicates that they, in fact, are not doing that. In fact, I know that when the biodefense budget was first being formulated by the Congress in the wake of the attacks in 2001, that they set up a separate fund. It is a sizable fund, now about $1.6 billion. And originally that was not to go to the National Institutes of Health. I and others argued that we should, in fact, give that money to the National Institutes of Health because they were best able to ensure quality. So it really is a different pool of money. Now, one can argue that biological weapons are or are not as great a threat as nuclear weapons or conventional bombs or securing our borders. But in fact, we have a series of terrorist threats against which we must defend. The money in bioterrorism is being well spent by the National Institutes of Health, in my view, and this argument, I think, in the end, will go away.
Well, we're going to revisit this issue because it's a very interesting issue. Just one other point to make on that. There are those who might argue that the biggest threat to our health coming from outside, offshore, from another place, might be something like the avian flu, which would kill many millions of people if it were to mutate and to harm them, you know, into a form that humans could transmit it. Would money like... Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just going to say the money, you know, our hospitals, how could our hospitals handle an overflow of cases that might come into them if they were not prepared for it?
And as I started to say, I would agree with that. I think that avian flu and other natural infectious diseases are major threats. And what we really need to do is reinvigorate our public health system. In fact, after the anthrax attacks of 2001, we began to invest very heavily in public health, and we are much better prepared today to defend against any natural or intentional disease than we were at that time. We certainly were better prepared to deal with the SARS outbreak because of anthrax 2001 than otherwise would have been the case.
You know, I was listening to a speech you gave. It's published online. You marked that a lot of microbiologists are worried. Quote, "We're all going to jail." The impression is that maybe people aren't clear in what policies are when it comes to doing work on some of these bioterror agents, and they may be actually stepping over the bounds and don't know it. Is that the case?
I think that we have a new responsibility in the community to, in fact, know what the laws and regulations are. And there has been concern that there will be new laws or are new laws and regulations that put us at jeopardy. We've seen a couple of well-publicized cases that really do strike alarms within the scientific community. I and others seem to be out there daily trying to alert our colleagues to the behavior that we have to exert, and certainly at academic institutions, we now have biosafety officers paying very careful attention to how to keep us out of jeopardy with the legal requirements that we now face.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira, great show, and thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Very timely. Yeah, I think at least half, maybe over half now, of the graduate students in biosciences, especially here in California, but I think it's across the country, are from foreign countries. Many have really deplorable human rights records, you know, like China. Many of them stay here, even though they sign a visa, a promise that they'll go back to their home country. But for the ones that do go back to their home country, often the top students, you know, 4.0, 5.0 students, just brilliant people, how are we going to control the knowledge they take back to their home country? You know, Japan gained a huge amount of knowledge from Western science from sending the students to Germany and so on, and look what they did, you know, in China in World War II. I really don't think the Chinese have any more moral qualms than the Japanese did in the 30s and 40s. So I think there should be some kind of crash program to prevent these students either from coming to this country or from leaving the country once they graduate, and really carry an encyclopedic knowledge of biological warfare if they so choose.
Dr. Atlas?
I think it's important that we recognize that the life sciences are an international endeavor. The United States has no monopoly on this research. We gain, and other countries gain, by the knowledge that we share. In this era of fear of terrorism, we also must recognize that infectious diseases know no boundaries. If we look at the SARS outbreak in China, it was critical that individuals there have the knowledge base as to how to contain that disease, which ultimately protected us. The more we've looked at this, we do not want to build boundaries where that exchange does not occur. Rather, we want to encourage it. On the other hand, what we want to instill globally is an ethical value system that says none of us, not in China, not in Iran, not in the United States, will we engage in activities that further the threat of bioterrorism.
Well, you know, let me just play the naive side here. I mean, if a country wants to engage, or, you know, a rogue bunch of people want to engage in bioterrorism, no amount of an ethical code is going to stop them, is it?
Not really. The ethical code is aimed at helping us in the legitimate scientific community protect our endeavor. It does not do away with criminals. It doesn't do away with terrorists. For that, we rely upon law enforcement. But we have an obligation to expose activities that may contribute to bioterrorism, and that in turn helps law enforcement. So more and more there is a conversation between the scientific community and the national security and international security communities. I've met recently with Interpol. I work on an FBI task force aimed at helping to identify anyone who would be using science for nefarious purposes.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about science and ethics this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we can go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can take a call from Dan in Denver. Hi, Dan.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi.
Great show.
Thank you.
I'm curious as to how the ethical standards of science apply to the defense research groups like DARPA, who are engaged in developing weapons and human performance-enhancing drugs and things like that, that I think raise serious ethical issues.
Dr. Atlas?
Certainly the concerns about some of the military research, some homeland security research, have been heard by us. What Margot Somerville and I propose is to institute an ethics review process similar to what the Department of Energy actually does in much of its research, so that at every stage of the research, we would look at safety, security, and ethics, and there would be members of the public involved in that process, so that the sorts of concerns that you raise hopefully would be allayed, that we would not be crossing lines of concern.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. You talked about how difficult it was to train doctors to recognize that a new patient might be infected with a bioterror agent. They've never seen it before. So you're actually hiring actors and special effects people to do role-playing for doctors to recognize it?
That's correct. We recognized that the medical community was ill-prepared in 2001 to recognize anthrax or smallpox or the other biothreat diseases. They've never seen it. Hopefully they never will. But they just might, and that first case diagnosis is critical. Doctors learn by experience. They don't learn as well from textbooks and pictures. So what we have is the use of standardized patients, actors, educators, really, who, using sophisticated makeup techniques and acting techniques, can portray a disease. So we have some who can be talking to you and suddenly their speech is slurred, and we see descending paralysis, as would occur if there was an attack with botulinum toxin. We have other individuals where we can have them bleed from the eye and the nose and the mouth and the ears, as would occur in case of Ebola. We can present these to the medical community, to law enforcement. We can train individuals at airports to recognize such individuals so that we reduce the threat of spread of disease and increase our public health preparedness.
When you say you do this, is it just you, or is there a national program to train doctors like this?
We have a center at the University of Louisville funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we have a large program. We're out there daily training thousands of individuals, not only in the Louisville area and Kentucky, but throughout the nation, using these standardized patients. So we are progressively helping to train our public health response network.
Can you stay with us a little longer, Dr. Atlas? We're going to have to take a break.
I certainly can.
We're going to have to take a break. We're talking about being prepared for another bio attack and the kinds of things we might be doing. And stay with us. We'll be right back with Ronald Atlas after this break. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I am Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about science and public policy and bioterrorism. And just a reminder that we are continuing to monitor reports on the Pope's condition. And if it changes or any developments from the Vatican, we will keep you informed. I'm talking now with Dr. Atlas about science policy. Do you think that the Centers for Disease Control, you mentioned them, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has a big enough budget to combat, to deal with bioterrorism? I thought I'd heard that their budget actually had been cut.
I think that we continue to see issues surrounding the adequacy of the public health funding. It's not only issues with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it is also with the World Health Organization.
Mm-hmm.
What we need is a disease surveillance system that is global in reach, that will detect any outbreak of disease early and allow the community to respond very quickly.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that has not been set up yet.
We're working on it. We keep looking for increased funding. Certainly, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has greatly improved its activities after 2001. But I think I and they would argue that we still have a long ways to go if we're to reach the point where we can assure the public that they are well protected.
All right, I got about one or two questions. I'm going to give you maybe I gave it to you last time you were here, my blank check question. If you had a blank check and you could write it to any amount of money for any kind of service or something you needed to purchase, where would you spend it? What would you do with it?
I'd invested in the public health system. I'd invested both within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, reaching down to the states, and even more importantly, I'd look beyond our borders to helping the World Health Organization. the fact that when there's a major disease outbreak, the World Health Organization often must first do fundraising before they can send people to respond, I think is a critical lacking in the system. We should have an adequate reserve so that wherever we see danger, we can send the proper public health authorities.
You sound like a general saying, let's invest it in the troops, the frontline troops.
I think that's true. I think that personnel and preparedness go together. So training of individuals, being able to respond to emergencies is absolutely critical. We can't get away from the knowledge base of people in the public health community.
All right. I want to thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. And good luck
to you.
You're
most welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome, and have a good weekend. Ronald Atlas, past president of the American Society for Microbiology, is also graduate dean, professor of biology and public health, and co-director of the Center for Deterrence of Biowarfare and Bioterrorism at the University of Louisville.